I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, English author Catherine May reflects on her love of winter, the cold weather, and just why it's so valuable.
In Celtic culture, winter is seen as, it's kind of labelled as gestational, which I think is such a beautiful way to think about it. Like the year is pregnant, ready to come into life in the spring. But nobody would say that pregnancy is not a valuable state. I think we see it as incredibly important and really prized within human society.
And later, where did all the magic go? And how do we rediscover the joy of being enchanted?
I think we reach an age where that sense that the world has latent magic in it that's there waiting for us to discover becomes embarrassing, you know? And it's not the business of the rational, busy world. And it's not the business of an adult.
The healing power of winter and finding moments of enchantment in an anxious age. That's coming up on Life Examined. While most of us can't wait for some spring air, it's the cold season, the winter, that offers us a chance to retreat from life, a period to regroup and reflect. And as maybe you can hear in my voice, sometimes it results in an actual cold, too. As depressing as it may sometimes feel, wintering is something we all need, physically and psychologically. Plants and creatures of the natural world lay fallow and hibernate, while most of us retreat indoors, lay low, and slow down. And amidst the trend to downplay hardships and be constantly upbeat and cheery, the dark days of winter can offer a place of stillness and a time to embrace solace and sadness and our darker emotions. English writer Catherine May also calls winter a time for, quote, letting your spare time expand, getting enough sleep, resting, a radical act, but it is essential. Catherine May is the author of the book Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times, and she joins me now for the full hour. Well, Catherine May, welcome to the program. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
You know, I'm very lucky in that I get a chance to spend a lot of time in Southern California, where there's not much of a winter, although this year that could be debated with all of the rain. But I'm speaking to you today from a snowy Colorado kind of atmospheric place just outside of the mountains. And it's 30 degrees and it's about to snow and will be 30 degrees for the next 10 days, it appears. And I suppose I am someone who is sitting with the concept of wintering and the frustration of the cold, but also loving it, knowing the snow will arrive. And I wanted to start with just your ideas of wintering, because I think this is the first time our listeners get to hear you talk about it, and we still are in winter. And so welcome us a little bit to that book, and maybe what was behind some of the ideas that you were trying to get to.
Sure. Well, I've been following your cold snap from afar because it seems really fascinating and extreme. So wintering is the idea that all of us have periods in our life that are downtimes, that are times when we feel forcibly cut off from the outside world. And it might come from like a personal crisis, a divorce, the loss of a job, a mental or physical illness, a bereavement, something like that. I mean, God forbid, a pandemic. But it also might come from just a change that's trying to happen in our lives. And it takes us down for a while. And I think probably every one of us has had that experience of watching the outside world carry on as normal and feeling like we're uniquely cut off from it, that everybody else is fine and we have fallen through the cracks. And that often comes with this huge sense of failure because it isn't spoken about very much. Like it's invisible, and so we're invisible and we're left to deal with it on our own. And I really wanted to write about those times, but I also have a love of winter. It's my favourite season. I quite like autumn too, but anything too warm and I lose interest. And I wanted to talk about the beauty that I perceive in that time of year and how beauty and hardness can come together, that it doesn't have to be easy to be beautiful, and that there's so many depths of understanding we can find in studying the wintering world, you know, the natural world of plants and animals and how they survive the winter.
You know, it's interesting. One of the most interesting periods of my life was working as a grief counselor. And
oh, wow.
The way you described what wintering is, this idea of the world going on as normal, but you yourself have changed or something feels dislocated. That to me is such an experience of grief in what I've noticed in myself or in the clients I worked with. And so I'm just kind of fascinated by this idea of how these psychological states can mirror also a season, one in which we've been through, you know, in countless years of our lives.
Yeah, that makes so much sense to me. I think the first time that you experience the loss of someone that you love, it's an instant change. Like you're suddenly inducted into this world that was previously invisible to you. And even if you've watched it from the outside and you know about it, you can't possibly be ready for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for loads of us, actually, we haven't watched it from the outside. It's been hidden from us. And so it comes as a terrible shock. And of course, I think the thing to talk about, too, is that people aren't always very sympathetic towards us in our grief or in our despair or in our sickness. You know, they lose interest or they don't know what to say to us. They don't know how to deal with it, and they might not be able to accept it themselves. But you know, it is a very particular psychological encounter. It's almost a space. Like I always think about it as a room. You know, a sort of big empty white space where we feel so exposed and so vulnerable and so alone. And what fascinates me is how different kind of winters can talk to each other. They're very similar experiences. And there's a commonality there that's hidden because we, you know, it's a time when we tend to be alone.
You talk about a very moving moment in the book Wintering where your son was going through an incredibly difficult period in his life and you had to make a hard decision. And I want you to talk about that because it seems to get to some of the things we're talking about right now. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. So essentially, I mean, my son, when he was six, just reached a point where he could no longer go to school. It was so distressing for him. And we were, as parents, we were desperate. It's so awful to see your child so upset. And we sought advice everywhere we could. And the only answer we kept getting was, you just have to force him in. Don't worry about it. They stop crying eventually. Or, you know, like if you take them into school enough, they'll accept that that's the rule and they'll give in. And I couldn't accept that. You know, I felt like that was such a brutal thing to do to a child that was telling you that they were distressed. And in the time that I spent trying to help him get into school, trust was breaking down between us. And I got to the point where I couldn't do it any longer. And I couldn't be part of this brutal system that said that his feelings didn't matter. And so we pulled him out of school, which was not something I'd ever wanted or planned to do. And I was, you know, I was scared as well. Like I was scared that it wasn't the right thing for him. I was scared about what it was going to do to me. Like I just, you know, I'd just come out of a period of him not being in school because he was too young. You know, I didn't want to go back there. I'd found it really hard. But between us, we had to figure it out because I couldn't keep forcing him to do that. And I wanted to show him that his feelings mattered and to give him permission in the future to meet his own needs when they arose and not to traumatize himself, forcing himself through it.
There's something in that story to me which is so important, which is that sometimes there needs to be just an acceptance of hardships or of difficulty in a way that is not masked. I mean, I think even in psychology, we're always talking about positive reframes like, yeah, but you'll be stronger if you keep at it, or if you'll, there's a bright side to this. And I think that what I understand about what you were talking in that book was you were taking your son out to say like, you're going through a hard time and that's okay. Let's just be in that hard time together right now.
Yeah. And to say, actually, as your mother, it's my job to be in that hard time with you. Like that's the greatest thing that I can offer you, is not to shut down that hard time or to deny it or to undermine it or belittle it, but to actually live that with you alongside you and to fully honor it as a valid state of being. And it's, I've struggled to find too many echoes of that. Like, we're beginning to understand that we need to do that for adults, but we're still visiting on children the message that their feelings aren't real, you know, that they're not fully formed yet, that you can't trust them. And it's something I've never regretted. It wasn't easy. And it had, you know, huge financial consequences for us, as you can imagine. But I felt the trust between us rebuild during that time. And now, as he's a little older and he's back in school, which everybody told me I'd never get him back into school if I did that. And, you know, I was making a run for my own back, all those wonderful phrases. Now I see in him this amazing ability for compassion towards other children who are suffering, and this ability to be with people when they are also struggling. And I'm so glad that we gave him that. We gave him the opportunity to develop that.
I know you really believe in just the kind of wisdom that there are cyclical patterns in life, or that's all there is. There's cyclical patterns of life, that things come and keep things go. And, you know, even in my training as a therapist, I mean, we are taught to acknowledge that when people are in deep distress, if you can just keep them moving a bit, things will clear after time, you know, especially in acute cases of suicidality. I mean, there's this thought that, like, this will pass at a certain point. I mean, you know, not always for people, but I think that's maybe something you're getting to as well when we begin to think of what a season is, or, you know, what a mental state is, or what a very dark period of emotionality is. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you absolutely do. And the insight comes from suicidality as well, because for most of my teens, I lived with a strong urge to finish my life. That was something that was very, very normal for me. And it reached this kind of peak when I was 17, when I had what I love to term a breakdown, which I know isn't a scientific term, but it's like a meaningful term, I think, in our folk culture, where everything stopped for me for a while. And I had to face my, you know, this suicidal habit of thinking, actually, which is how I came to understand it. And yeah, I realized that the point when I turned the corner was when I realized how long I'd lived with those feelings without acting on them. And I realized the value of that moment and the next moment and getting through 10 minutes rather than making any big plans, you know, and predictions for how I was going to survive 10 years. And once I had that insight, I kind of realized that I had an instinct for survival altogether, you know, that there must be a part of me that wanted to survive because I had survived. And that, just building that moment upon that moment and going and making a cup of tea when things got hard, making those tiny movements and gestures towards the next phase that was very close by, were absolutely what I followed for a very long time.
Yeah, there is something kind of mysterious in us. It's some much deeper animal sense of that we will continue to keep going. I just remember I had a teacher once, a well-known therapist, who was going through a really difficult, kind of dreadful period of her life, a divorce, and was driving down the street and was like, what am I doing? But at the same time noticed that her eyes were checking the rearview mirrors to keep her safe on the road.
Yes. Yeah.
And I just thought that's so interesting. I remember Gary Snyder, the poet, once telling me that, you know, even when you're not aware of it, your body continues to breathe. There's just these natural functions in us to keep us going. And I love thinking about that sometimes.
Yeah, it's really affirming. And I don't think that people who don't experience those thoughts and who've never been to that incredibly dark and self-destructive place, I don't think they ever realize how much of survival is based on small moments of determination and distraction. Honestly, just distracting myself for 10 minutes. Life is knitted together of those moments sometimes. And there are times when we become really conscious of how long 10 minutes can feel. And then other times when it eases off and life feels simple again. Mm-hmm. And they do come.
Yes. Well, one thing I love about the book Wintering is how you talk about not just yourself, but that this idea of going into some kind of hibernation is not just a human thing, but one that plants and animals do. And I wonder if you could pick a few examples that fascinated you when you were researching and learning about this book.
Oh, yeah, I got really into hibernation. Because actually there's, hibernation is just one of the many behaviours that we see in the animal kingdom that are about conserving energy over the winter. Hmm. And I got to meet one of the true hibernators, which is the dormouse, which I did not realise that Americans don't have. Like
a dormouse?
How do you guys get by without dormice? They're so cute.
Yeah. I don't even know if I've heard of them. So anyway, continue. Clearly I'm missing something big in my life.
There's one in Alice in Wonderland, which I think is like the major American touch point with a dormouse. But they're a little bit like a hamster with a long tail, and they're kind of sandy coloured. And I got to meet one at my local animal conservation centre, and they unpacked one, a hibernating one, for me, which is something they do regularly to make sure that they're still okay, because they take in vulnerable dormice. I mean, I can't imagine anything much more vulnerable than a dormouse anyway, but they take in ones that might not survive the winter and monitor their hibernation because they're becoming endangered. And I got to hold this hibernating dormouse, and it completely changed my perception of what hibernation was, because I'd always imagined it as like a cozy experience, you know, snuggling down in a lovely little nest and being all warm and lovely. And hibernation is actually a very raw act of survival. And when you touch that dormouse, it's so cold. It's just, it's 4 degrees centigrade above freezing. So it's ice cold to the touch. And yet at the same time, it doesn't feel dead. And there's something that does to your brain. Like it doesn't make any sense when you touch that ice cold thing and it's still fleshly. And they have to put on so much weight in the months running up to, I mean, their whole waking life is dictated by having to put on as much fat as they can in order to survive the very long winter. And so they're squishy. They're like deeply, deeply squishy, and they're round like a little ball. And you can gently poke your finger into them and leave fingerprints in them. They're so kind of made up of this fluid fat. And that, I mean, I will never forget that experience. Mm. And about every 6 months, I repost my video of the dormouse onto Instagram because I just can't resist it. Like, it's like, guys, did I ever tell you I held a dormouse? You know? But like, what does that tell us? You know, we know that humans don't hibernate in that sense, but it does tell us that hibernation is about fighting the brutality of a hard winter, rather than making ourselves soft and comfortable. Hmm. And that to me is such a inspiring thing. It's much more inspiring than any kind of like urge to make the best of things. It's like, no, what amazes me about creatures, and we're a creature too, is that we can sometimes hunker down when the world is giving us so little and still get through it and get through it to the next summer.
Hmm. And what stays with me about that story, among a lot of things, is just how cold the mouse was. I mean, like on the verge of death almost. I mean, we couldn't live with that kind of a body temperature. It had found a way to be just almost at this liminal place where it is using such little energy through its reserves to just kind of keep the heart beating at that point. And I find that to be a very kind of moving image.
And even then, the heart is only just beating. You know, it's so slow. They're barely breathing. Their kidneys aren't functioning. And what happens is that they naturally stir about every 6 weeks during their hibernation and just rise up to consciousness enough for their kidneys to flush again and for all of those kind of basic bodily processes to happen And then they drop deep, deep into this stasis again. Mm. And I would love to know what dormouse consciousness is like during that state. I wonder what it's like.
It feels almost dreamlike, maybe, in a sense. I mean, that's what I would project on it, that you're in some weird conscious, unconscious space. I mean, who knows what it's like to be a dormouse, right? Yeah. But this is where
that's a big question in the first place, isn't it?
But that's where my mind goes, at least. So
yeah. The ontology of a dormouse. But it's as close to death as I think any of us can imagine.
Yeah.
And yet it tells us everything about life. Like everything is there. It's absolutely wonderful.
And I take it that it's not just animals, but the plant kingdom has interesting stories of wintering as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know this, right? Because we see the leaves drop off trees in the winter. Yeah. So we're all really clear that something happens. But what I didn't realize until I started researching the detail of what was happening when I was, writing Wintering, is that that when trees drop their leaves, they've already formed the buds that are ready for next spring. So the tree is looking after itself. It's again getting itself down to the minimal use of energy it can possibly do. Mm. But it's absolutely ready to spring into action, and it's in no way dead. It's just poised. And while it's doing that, it's doing such important work in the forest, because the trees are what hold the soil together over winter when the soil becomes very wet and there's rains which can really erode the soil. We rely on the structure made by trees to hold the whole forest together. And, they're hosting hibernating insects and squirrels and all kinds of creatures. So even in this state when they look so bare and like there's no life in them, trees are doing extraordinary work in the forest. And there's a parallel for us there as well, that, when we're in stasis, we're an important part of the human community still, I think.
Mm. And it just occurs to me, and this might be a very obvious thought, but just, where I am sitting now in this kind of freezing, snowy weather at the moment, like I am not really out making a lot of new social connections right now. It doesn't, I almost don't feel like that energy is in me at the moment to go and be out in the neighborhood or be out with thousands of people. Maybe I should, but there really is this sense that like I am hunkering down quietly using minimal energy, fixing things around a house, reading, writing. I mean, it's not even a conscious thought. It's just the way that I am right now. It's where my energy is, which all seems to be quite paralleled to the natural world around me.
Yeah, and it seems to me that we've forgotten about the important work that happens in the darker months, that those months are about restoration, they're about repair, they're about reflection, loads of R's apparently. They're about that kind of work that needs to be done underneath the visible surface of life. And when we don't do it, things fall apart really quickly. Our houses fall into disrepair, or we don't learn the lessons that we need to learn because we've not made the time and space to think about what's happened. And yet we don't talk about that. We talk about creativity and teamwork, and these are all the important values that we want people to do, being sociable, being active. But I don't even think that we're not connected during those times. I think that maintenance work that we do is part of our connection. It's just this different aspect of it to the very big, loud, sociable time.
Yeah.
And there's in Celtic culture, winter is seen as, it's kind of labelled as gestational, which I think is such a beautiful way to think about it. Like the year is pregnant, ready to come into life in the spring. But nobody would say that pregnancy is not a valuable state. I think we see it as incredibly important and sort of really prized within human society. And that's what, we can be pregnant in different ways too, and the year can be pregnant.
Yeah. And this is always what made living in Southern California a bit strange to someone who grew up on the East Coast in Colorado, was that, you know, winter would come, but not certainly with the kind of snow and feeling of desolation and lack of light that it does in so many other parts of the Northern Hemisphere. Mm. And there are micro changes in the season. This year has been a particularly rainy year. And so I'm going to say it was winter this year. Okay, I will admit.
It sounds like you guys have.
But yeah, how do you feel that that does impact someone? I mean, there's, of course, equatorial cultures as well that don't experience what I'm talking about. But you know what I'm saying? What do you think that does to the psyche after a while when days just kind of feel the same year round?
Yeah, I mean, if I can meet, if I ever come across an equatorial native, I will always ask them about that because I'm quite fascinated. Because actually, I find it very hard to imagine life without seasons. I'm quite reliant on them to give me rhythm throughout my year. But people have told me that actually, if you live in an equatorial country, there are ways of marking the transition through the year anyway, that aren't so dependent on the weather. The Christian calendar is a good example of that, that's been adopted in a lot of those societies where people are still following like a progress through the year and different movements through it. But people also talk about how tired they get of endless summer and that there's this sense of real weariness and kind of literal burnout that comes. And I remember a Singaporean woman telling me that, it's so common for people to leave that very hot zone at some point during the year for some relief for it. And I obviously those people are much more used to it than we might be, but there is a sense that we need variation across the year and we need some kind of structure that gives us permission to retreat a bit. And to not be up, not be high all the time, to fall quiet for a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something that I'm always exploring when I get the chance because it's not something I fully understand. I've definitely got like a northern climate temperament.
Yes, of course. And to me, I think it brings up a really interesting question of the power of contrast in life. I remember speaking to a psychologist who said it could be that a lot of our sense of happiness comes out of contrast, that there has to be one thing to compare to the other. When something feels uniform, it's hard to get any sense of emotional differentiation. I mean, think about great art or photography. What is it? It's transition of light, it's contrast of images. And there's something to me that is very powerful in that, knowing that something is going to change and therefore we have a place to go to and arrive to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think that talks to me about emotional states as well. Mm-hmm. We have this aim to be happy and I'm not sure that's really meaningful on its own. You know, like I actually feel like we should aim for happiness to be one of the spectrum of emotions we feel.
Right.
And I actually think that we can value the darker emotions as much as happiness if we're allowed to feel all of them. And actually periods of sadness can be really helpful and satisfying in a way that isn't jolly or necessarily like very presentable to the outside world, but it is a purity. You know, there's this purity to the emotion that I think feels sometimes right for us. We need to feel it. Mm. And yet we don't allow ourselves those darker ones. We don't feel comfortable with them. And we've convinced ourselves they're not safe.
Yes.
Like, there's nothing unsafe about being sad. Mm. And in fact, it's what's unsafe is to keep pushing it away.
Well, one thing that California shares as well as the UK is a beautiful coastline, and I know which means a lot to you as well. And I just want to spend a minute saying that I'm one of my great joys is being in cold water and in oceans, and that's something that you write about as well. And your love of or the experiences you shared getting in freezing cold seas up there, and maybe talk about how that ties in maybe to what we're talking about here a little bit.
Yeah, there's a real contrast. I have this great yearning to explore the California coast one day, which I really hope is going to come true in the next few years. Because I love more than anything a craggy, crashing coastline. Uh-huh. That's my favourite thing in the world.
We have plenty of it, so yes, come on up.
But yeah, I mean, I've always been very drawn to getting into the sea. And, you know, that for me is... It's not just about the act of swimming. Like, it's not about exercise or something, you know, something as kind of flat as that. It's about entering this very different space and the way that being in the sea alters your consciousness as soon as you're there. You enter into this very different kind of sensory landscape. The sound is different. You know, your skin is touching water all over. And there's a sense of sort of spaciousness that I find in the sea, but also this contact with enormous energy and feeling small compared to it. And yeah, I don't know. I find myself very disinterested in kind of beautiful flat Mediterranean seas. They're too warm. There's not enough drama. Mm. What I love is the wildness of the sea and the way that, you know, I live a 5-minute walk from the sea, and so I get to see it most days. And the way it has different moods that are just constantly shifting over it, and sometimes you can watch them change, you know, before your eyes. The sea offers you a different thing every day, and you bring yourself to it, and therefore you see a reflection of where you are on that day. I didn't always live by the sea, but I don't think I'd ever live away from it now.
And if you're just joining us, my guest is Catherine May. She's the author of Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. And coming up next, in just a moment, we'll discuss her latest book, which is called Enchantment, Awakening Wonder in an Anxious Age. This is Life Examined on KCRW. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We just heard British author Catherine May share her thoughts on wintering and why embracing the cold and harshest months of the year can be not just rejuvenating, but also healing. May's love of the sea, its quote, wildness and shifting moods, has become a source of healing as well as one of joy and magic. Plunging into the cold English waters is also one of the many instances that inspired Catherine May to write her latest book called Enchantment, Awakening Wonder in an Anxious Age. Let's dive back in. I think this takes us to the latest book. It just feels that somehow these books are connected in a way that I'm going to let you describe. But tell me how you see moving from wintering to this latest project, Enchantment.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say they're directly sequential in lots of ways. And I mean, I think I spent a lot of time asking myself, like, what is the book I need to write after wintering? Mm. And in lots of ways that felt like pressure, you know,
yes.
People, yeah. It had been so warmly received. And, I heard so much from people about how it completely changed the way they thought about, this season that they lived through every year. And there was a big part of me that thought, well, how do I follow this? But then also that question was really exciting because, like, what follows wintering? Like, what do we need next? What is the phase after that? And the answer became really clear to me as I tried to emerge from the pandemic, because that was a grand winter that for me was better than for many other people. Like I was actually quite comfortable in the space a lot of the time. But at the same time as the months wore on, I realized that I was losing a lot too. And that despite my love of solitude, even I'd had too much solitude. And I felt very burnt out by it and very foggy, like clouded over. I couldn't access my own thoughts. And I you know, I couldn't even get a handle on time anymore after a few months. And yet, when the world started to open up again, I didn't want to go back to normal, and I couldn't go back to normal because everything had changed. And so that was that's the transition, I think, between the two books. It's like, well, what next? How do we go back in? Mm. And how do we make it good? Like, how do we make it beautiful and meaningful again?
In some ways, it almost feels like a changing of the season. I mean, you didn't write about spring per se, but so often the season that comes next is one of wonderment because we feel as if things come alive again. And that to me is almost the most fascinating moment of anything, that life kind of returns in a way that is beautiful and unexpected, but we also know it's coming. But but that feeling of enchantment, I know it's something that you, or not just you, but we tend to think about as almost a childlike emotion, right? Like something we had access to at younger ages. And I hate to think we grow out of it, but maybe we do, or we become more cynical, or we say, oh, I've seen that before. Who cares?
Yeah.
So Dada, take me from there. Where does that kind of thought land with you?
Yeah, well, I think it's something we very deliberately grow out of, actually. Mm. You know, I think we reach an age where that sense that the world has latent magic in it that's there waiting for us to discover, it becomes embarrassing, you know, and it's not the business of the rational, busy world, and it's not the business of an adult. And yet there also comes a point when we begin to miss that. And that's when we struggle to get it back again. You know, we walk so far away from it, we lose our skill for feeling that intense engagement with things that we find beautiful and utterly fascinating. That was the territory I wanted to go into, which is quite challenging territory for me, because it feels like it could be too soft almost, you know. After writing about the hard winter, what do I have to say about this real yearning that I had for awe, you know, for wonder, for magic, not in the kind of magic trick sense, but in the sense that not everything is explicable to me, and that it's bristling with this energy that is just beautiful and mysterious at the same time. And how do I enter into a spiritual life that I have never had and don't know how to have? So yeah, all of those questions came into the book as I sat down to write. Quite intimidating questions, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm wondering where the investigations began to take you. I mean, both in the way that you've studied dormice and hibernating creatures, but certainly I know that one thing you do so well is talk about the internal and external, and I'm kind of curious where you thought you had to explore as you launched into this project.
Well, and I think what I'd say about that is that the book's about uniting those two, like rejoining mind and body, and kind of finding a way to write about things that don't have language and that can't and shouldn't have language. And so getting into contact with that really embodied state of being rather than the state of being that exists just in my head, which is, you know, only a small part of me. I had to begin with very simply learning to move again after getting stuck behind my desk and kind of clinging to it for a whole pandemic and, you know, losing all my habits of movement and of exploration and of variation, and learning to feel curiosity again. And so, like, right at the beginning of the book, I literally just take myself out to walk and I don't know where I'm going, but I know that I've got to move myself again in order to get the cogs of my brain moving. But then after that, I began to think about where I wanted to visit. Like, where did I want to go to follow my own fascination? like, where was that tingle of curiosity? And the question is further back than just, oh, I'll work out what I want to see and go and see it, because I'd lost touch with that very sense of curiosity and with that desire and that pull of the outside world. So, yeah, I was starting from a very low base.
I know you live, for example, in a really beautiful part of England, and it's near Canterbury, where there's some really amazingly spiritual sites. I know some of them were on your list as well, but I'd love for you to talk about that, or just the places that you were looking for some magic, which is a word you do use in the book quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm reappropriating the word magic, yes, for sure. I love it, actually. My editor kept saying, not so much magic, please. You
know? Uh-huh. I'll take it, a little less of that.
Yeah. No more abracadabra. Uh-huh. So I do. I live about 8 miles outside of Canterbury, which is, as well as being the site of what likes to call itself the number one cathedral, which always makes me laugh on Twitter. It's part of an ancient pilgrim route that actually can be mapped back to the Stone Age, that ran right across the bottom of the country and then across to Europe. And so it's part of this flow of connection across the world that has existed through time immemorial. And I went to, as part of the research for the book, I went to visit this ancient sort of healing well that sits just on the outside of Canterbury, and which we know has had long Christian associations, but which probably was a healing well before then as well. And in its current state, it's surrounded by this very beautiful old worn stone surround with the crest of the Black Prince on it. So that seems to date it to the 14th century, or at least some of it. And there's a mythology around that too. And it has these steps down to this still pool of water. And so to visit the well, you have to go down towards it and enter into this different space. Like, it's so cleverly set up. Our ancestors understood something that we rarely understand now, which is that we need to make a transition into that state of prayerfulness, or that state of openness and wondering and inquiry. And it was so striking to me the first time I went down there that you could see the evidence of generations taking, troubled minds down there, because this was a well that you went to if you had leprosy or if you had other diseases, and you asked it for healing. And it was hard not to feel that sense of connection with other unquiet minds as I stepped down those steps and saw my own reflection in the pool. And I was there yesterday because the launch of a book is a wonderful time, but also a very unsettling time.
Yes.
And the best thing I could think of to do was to go and visit that well.
One of our early guests on the program was a wonderful travel writer. Well, more than that, Timothy Egan, who wrote a book called Pilgrimage. And I believe it starts there. And he talks a lot about that. And I think gets to something that seems to be, I don't want to say necessarily lost, but might have been a bigger part of earlier cultures, earlier Christian or going back to early Greek cultures, which was this acknowledgement of having to move somewhere to engage in pilgrimage, to make a symbolic gesture towards something else. There were famous temples, the mysteries of Eleusis, where people would go, and there was thought that they would take a spiked barley and enter these psychedelic states. I mean, but there were so many examples of this. And I think that you're tapping into something that feels a little bit more immemorial, something that is of a different era, but certainly still part of, I think, who we are.
Yeah. I mean, pilgrimage is a process. That's what's, it's a long process, and it's a commitment. And it's a commitment to enter into a different state of mind, whether or not you take psychedelic wheat.
Sure.
But, it's it involves quite often self-denial or suffering, which is a very complex thing to engage in. But you're looking for a change in consciousness, and you're looking to enter into different society altogether, and into a sort of liminality, I think, when you go on a pilgrimage.
I'd love to hear some other examples, though, of where you began to find a sense of wonder or curiosity or awe, not just in some of the grand sites, but I take it you explored other things, maybe things that felt more mundane, but could also be filled with some of those descriptors that I just used.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic ended up doing me a favor in this sense, because when I started thinking about the book, I thought, oh, I'm going to have to go and visit mountains and grand landscapes and go and find these sites that have to give me awe. And actually, I couldn't do that. Like, those were forbidden from me because we were still in lockdown and we were still living under loads of restrictions. And I suddenly realized that's the point, that actually that's the lesson I needed to learn, that wonder didn't just exist elsewhere, that I needed to go looking for it closer to home, and that I could find it. And so the book's made up of quite a lot of small moments, actually, of, you know, going out and spending time with the moon, and feeling that communion with this object that's in the sky right above our heads every night, but which we rarely stop to think about what that means, that, you know, we are looking into outer space and sitting under the reflected light of this, of the sun, which is extraordinary. And I spent some time writing on the beach as well, and thinking really what the tides actually meant, you know, as they travelled around the world in a continuous loop, and how connected that made me, and how small I felt amid those things. Mm. But I also did go on some constrained missions eventually. And like, one of the most memorable ones for me was travelling up to Yorkshire to try and see my own Brocken spectre, which is something I'd always wanted to do. Would you like me to explain?
I'm afraid I don't follow exactly, so please.
That's fine. So a Brocken spectre is this meteorological phenomenon by which how do I explain this? If you're at the top of a mountain in the morning with the sun low behind you, and there's cloud cover underneath you, so the way that, you know, it fills the valley in the morning, what you'll see is a projection of your shadow across the cloud. But because you don't have a reference for the scale of it, it looks like a giant. And it might seem disconnected to you because the cloud might be floating away from you. So it doesn't feel like your shadow. It feels like something separate. But what's particularly fascinating about a Brocken spectre, because of the quality of light and the amount of water saturated in the air, is that it appears with a halo around its head, a corona, a kind of rainbow halo. And, you know, there's been accounts of these for a long time. You know, there's kind of Buddhists in monasteries at the top of mountains in Nepal who report seeing them. And there's, you know, they're recorded throughout literature, and Jung writes about them, and all kinds of people have written about them. And I've always wanted to see one. Like, they're this obsession of mine that's run through many, many years. And I've never been able to. So I went to a place that was famous for producing Brocken spectres to try and find one. Mm. And without giving loads away, I learned that it's the mission that's the important thing, and, you know, yes. whether or not you see the fascinating thing.
Oh, that's incredible. Reminds me of, I don't know how many sailors or people by the ocean looking for the green flash of light that is supposed to appear before, just as
the
sun goes down.
Is that Elmo's fire?
I don't know the reference exactly, but I know that I've never seen it, but it has forced me to look out over a sinking sun in the ocean 100 times, and I've never maybe regretted what it took me to get to that moment. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And actually, what you get from it, whatever you come to see, is an intense engagement and a deep quality of attention that doesn't get replicated by accident.
Yes.
And whatever you bring that quality of attention to, it will show you something. even if it's not Instagrammable.
Yeah. As we begin to wrap up our conversation, I'd love for you to just pick something from the book, maybe a moment or some thoughts you had that speak to some of the things that we're talking about.
Yeah, I'd love to read a section about the moon, I think. Danger, when it's always imminent, does harm. It doesn't need to actually arrive. You exhaust yourself in the act of forever looking over your shoulder. Your body readies itself to fight and never quite discharges the chemical cocktail. You channel it instead into anger and self-pity and anxiety and hopelessness. You divert it into work. But what you really do with every fibre of your being is watch. You are incessantly, exhaustingly alert. You don't dare ever let up, just in case the danger takes advantage of your inattention. I've forgotten what it feels like to have space in my brain for anything other than watching. For a long time I kept working, and for a while that felt like a life raft. But then, incrementally, it became impossible. I was aware of a fog descending, a seizing of the gears, but it seemed diffuse until now. One night I press the button on my electric toothbrush and find it only has the lowest burr of its battery left. The engine inside can barely shift the bristles. I see it clearly for the first time. This is me. I'm out of charge. I've been leaking out energy for too long, and I don't know how to get it back again. Waking in the middle of the night, I remember something that I used to do. I pad downstairs to greet the moon, and then sit in a garden chair and kick off my slippers. I let my bare feet make contact with the cold patio tiles, and I feel the tingle of exchange between the earth and me, the instant reciprocity. I close my eyes and let my mind sink downwards. I relieve myself of the duty to search for language. I let myself feel instead. I sit there embodied, immersed in the relief of it. As the moon keeps watch, I wonder how I could possibly have forgotten this.
It's been such a pleasure to spend this hour with Catherine May, our guest. She's the author of the new book, Enchantment, Awakening Wonder in an Anxious Age. Catherine, thank you so much just for your thoughtfulness and vulnerability and ideas today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That's been such a lovely conversation.
All right, that's it for this week. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Chime in on our Facebook page. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you next week.